Booster.
Go.
Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
And greetings from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is the February 5th, 2011 edition of Space Talk, brought to you by Space Florida, committed to expanding Florida's aerospace enterprise. Well, welcome aboard, everybody, for what I hope will be an hour of interesting conversation about our space program. And if you happen to be tuning in for the first time today, we do especially welcome you. This is the place where every Saturday at 2 o'clock we'll spend some time talking about our space program, every aspect of it, not just NASA, not just shuttle, but anything and everything under the sun or the universe, as the case may be. And of course, that's important not only to those of us who live here on the space coast, but as we truly do believe our space program important for everyone across the planet. And when we say planet, boy, that's been the topic of the week in space, truly. It's I think it's how you've got to think of ourselves these days. I don't think of ourselves as a bunch of nations. I don't think ourselves as a world or any other. I think we're on a planet. This is planet Earth, and we are on this planet together. And guess what? There are other planets out there. And in terms of scientific discovery, it appears there are more than 1,000 planets out there in surrounding other stars in our galaxy and beyond. And of course, that's only scratching the very, very top of the surface of all this. And as we continue talking today in our program, we're going to be joined later by a NASA planet hunter working the Kepler telescope, which has some news today or news this week. Jack Lissauer will be joining us from the Ames Research Center in California. Kepler launched from the Cape here in March of 2009. He's been up there a while looking specifically for other planets around other suns. And they have a lot of candidates, let's just say that. There are a lot of stuff out there, and it's a lot of intriguing ways that that conversation can go. And if you're like me, you probably do have some comments and questions, maybe for Jack later about planets, maybe for me about really anything having to do with the space program. What's on your mind today as we talk about our space program? Your comments and questions always welcome at 321-768-1240 is the telephone number for the studio here. Star 1240 is the number for AT&T wireless customers who live here on Florida's Space Coast. If you're listening to us online, you can, or just are more comfortable using email, you can send us an email to our address is spacetalking@aol.com. And all of those ways will get you into the studio and into part of the program today if you're interested. As we get you updated on some things that are going on, I think it's appropriate right now to go ahead and give you our regular weekly report, our regular weekly launch forecast, which is brought to you specifically by United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. And as we look at our launch forecast and consider Discovery as being the next up to bat on February 24th at 4:50 in the afternoon, Discovery was rolled out from the Vehicle Assembly Building out to Pad 39A at the Kennedy Space Center this past week. For what? Well, we've been here before, haven't we? We've already used these lines for its last time. Well, probably. If this thing gets off the ground, then indeed Discovery made its final trip on a crawlerway out to the pad here this week. Once with Discovery now back on the pad, pretty much everything gets back into the routine. You recall that this shuttle was scheduled for launch a long time ago, and then issues came up and launches were scrubbed. Cracks were found in the external tank. Additional cracks were found. Additional concerns were raised. We rolled Discovery back to the Vehicle Assembly Building for the Christmas holiday made some repairs, and now we're basically back to where we were last fall. And again, with the sort of a more or less routine countdown from here, hopefully we'll get off the ground on February 24th. The other big news having to do with the next space shuttle mission, which I think news that captivated the entire nation in one way or the other, was the decision and announcements here yesterday that Mark Kelly, the commander of Endeavour for the April 19th mission, the husband of Representative Gabby Giffords, who, of course, as you all know, was shot in Tucson a month ago. Well, the decision be made now that he is going to go ahead and fly that mission and resume training on Monday. I think, by and large, most of the nation seems to be behind it. I was reading some interesting commentary from sort of some non-space people, some just social commentary type folks that aren't from the technical community, and talking about how this whole ordeal and in the very public way that that Representative Giffords' health has been discussed, and the kind of things that Mark has been doing to be public about it all, has turned this, I guess the phrase is the nation's couple. And everyone just kind of adopted them as their own best friends. And it's been fun to watch that. It's been good because I think it's an opportunity for folks to see the space program in a different light, in a different way than we normally do. You know, and of course, growing up, it was all the astronauts and then the wives back at home. And now kind of it's interesting to see the focus on the wife. And rightfully so, with the husband taking care of things in the background, and there are a few folks that say basically he should stay home and take care of her, and I think those people don't understand the big picture. I don't think they understand the personalities that are involved. I don't think they understand the kind of the drive that this family has to be out there and serve and. Well, and frankly, to take the risks and put your life out there, as both husband and wife have done now, to serve their country and to serve the greater good. And yes, there's risks involved, again, you know, but risks can be mitigated, they can be trained for, they can be calculated, and you can add that all up and make the decision to go. And I think it's absolutely the right thing to do. And I think, again, once this flight gets off the ground here in April now, hopefully, a tremendous opportunity during this shuttle mission to call attention to not only the space program itself, as people will be interested in the launch, especially if the Representative Giffords, if she can actually make it to KSC by then. I know that's kind of their secret goal is which they said publicly, but the goal to get her to watch the launch from here. And then an opportunity really to honor and serve and recognize, you know, all that shooting meant and, you know, to honor those that died, to honor those that are injured and recovering, to talk about some of the issues that it brought up, the civility of our discourse, the political atmosphere, the polarizing that the politics have done to us, and here this noble effort to go into space and explore and utilize space in a peaceful manner. I mean, this is all good stuff, and I'm hopeful that appropriate ways will be found to recognize and honor and take advantage of that platform, if you will, that bully pulpit to make some good come out of all of this. And so I say, well done, Mark Kelly. It was the right decision. And we look forward to the training resuming on Monday and getting you out here and your crew out here to do the whole thing and get off the ground. Again, I hope on the 19th, the launch time, 7:48 p.m. on the 19th, as we talked about last week, official sunset time that day is 7:53. Isn't that a cool idea? Boy, lifting off just before launch. So anyway, and a quick shout out before we say take this break. Happy anniversary to Ed Mitchell. Crew member of Apollo 14. It was 40 years ago today that Alan Shepard and Ed Mitchell walked on the moon. When we return, Jack LaSauer from Ames Research Center. This is Space Talk, sponsored by Space Florida. You're listening to WMMB.
If it's happening in space, Jim Behnke is there. Okay, well, not in space, but he's all about it. This is Space Talk on WMMB.
Well, and welcome back, everybody, to Space Talk, brought to you by Space Florida, coming at you from Florida Space Coast, where I just happened to look up at the monitor here and just noticed for the first time today that it's 86 degrees here in the studio outside right now. That's amazing. Where'd all that warmth come from? Wow. Well, look, as you all know, if you've listened to me or know me in any way, you know, I'm truly, you know, your standard Star Trek guy, your seeking out new worlds kind of a guy. And as I've said before, and I'll say it right now, you know, if I look back at my career so far, especially going back to when I was a journalist at Florida Today, if I had to pick out, like, you know, three or four of the most top career moments, and moments that I'll remember the rest of my life, you know, certainly in that top trio, I don't know where it would place, would be the night I spent at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena when Voyager 2 was having its close encounter with Neptune, the planet Neptune. It was the last of the great planets that we had not been up close to yet. Of course, we've since done Pluto, but in terms of, and you know, there's that whole story about whether it's really a planet or not. But in terms of the great ones, the great gas giants, the true venture that the Voyager 2 was, you know, I remember sitting up all night watching those pictures come in one by one and hearing the cheering in the hall and having scientists come out and give us sort of the instant view of what this means and what's that telling us. And I will never forget that sense of exploration, that sense of excitement over discovering something brand new for the first time that no humans had ever experienced. And that was cool. Well, here we are all these years later, and, you know, the work is still being done. And just because we've discovered all the planets in our solar system, and maybe we have and maybe we haven't, you know, the big question has always been, are there other planets out there? Well, you'd think there are. You'd think that that'd be a fairly common thing. But until you actually see it, who knows? And now Kepler launches in March of 2009. And this week had an incredible announcement, and I'm gonna just give you these numbers, and then we'll break it down with our guest here in just a second. But Kepler planets, planet candidates, I should say, the possibility that these are planets, which is gonna take some time to confirm it. 1,235 planet candidates so far, of which 68 are about the size of our planet. 288 are just a little bit bigger than Earth, maybe as much as twice our size. 662, the same size, generally speaking, as Neptune. 165, as big as Jupiter. 19, larger than Jupiter. Of the 54 new planet candidates found in what's called the habitable zone, 54 planets found in the zone where water could exist on this planet because of their distance away from their particular sun, 5 are basically Earth-sized. You know, so and yet all this only found by looking at basically 1/400th of the sky. So there's still all this other sky they haven't even looked at yet, and they've already discovered candidates for this many planets, and only of the kind of planets that Kepler's capable of detecting. It's absolutely mind-boggling. So with all that, let's get into it. Let's get some help with all of this with Jack Lissauer. He is a co-investigator on the Kepler team. Holds a doctorate in applied math from UC Berkeley, which means he's 10 times smarter than all of us put together. And he is based at NASA's Ames Research Center in California. And Jack, welcome to the show. Appreciate you being on the phone with us today.
Well, I'm very glad to be here, Jim.
Well, let's dispense with some of the basics here and jump right into what I'm going to care about the most. You found all these planet candidates. Which one of them can host us? How soon can we get there? And when we get there, you know, are we going to have neighbors visiting us?
Well, Jim, we don't know if any can host us. There are a very small number which might be able to host us.
Yeah.
These Earth-sized planets in the habitable zone. And 4 out of those 5 actually are a fair amount bigger than Earth, and they could have very thick atmospheres. And the 5th one, well, that's nice and tiny and in the habitable zone, but because it's tiny and we haven't been looking that long, we're not sure it's there.
And these planets generally range, what, I think, did I see 2,000 light years away?
Well, the system that has six confirmed planets is about 2,000 light years away.
Yeah.
And that's about the characteristic distance of these other planets, or planetary candidates, more technically. But there are some that are only a few hundred light years away, and some that are several thousand light years.
Well, let's go back to the basics now. So let's talk about Kepler itself, the spacecraft. We've had Hubble, Compton, Gamma Ray, Spitzer, I mean, all these other ones. What made or what is making Kepler unique in what it does and how it does it?
Well, Jim, the spacecraft that you've mentioned are more general-purpose observatories to do a broad range of science, whereas Kepler is designed to do one thing especially well, and that means it can actually do two or three other things quite well, too, but it's really a planet-hunting telescope, and that is the entire focus. We only stare at the same field for the entire duration of our mission.
Okay, so this is a 1/400 square patch. Is that where it just stays concentrated?
That's right.
Okay.
And that's a small patch of the sky, but compared to Hubble, it's about 10,000 times as large a field of view.
Wow, okay. So the thing is about planet hunting, you know, you're not taking pictures of planets around other suns.
That's right, Jim.
You're seeing something, a wiggle of light, the spectra changing or something like that. How would you describe that?
Well, what we're seeing is the stars periodically dimming by a little bit as a planet passes between us and them. Now, in order to do that, we have to be in or very near the plane of the planet's orbit.
Oh, okay.
And therefore, most planets are not detectable in this way. That's why we need to have such a very large field of view by the standards of telescopes of this size in order to stare at more than 150,000 stars in order to get a large number where we happen to be in the plane of their planetary systems and the planets partially eclipse, or we call it transit, the disk of their stars.
So, and so there's so many candidates or so many stars out there that, you know, just our position, statistics are going to line up to say you're going to at least catch a few of these where the planets. But if that planet is bigger and inclined past the diameter of the sun, then it can go by a million times. You'll never see it.
That's right, Jim. Unless it has another planet which passes between us and the star, because if it has another planet which happens to be along the line of sight, if it has a big companion that's not too far in orbit, that big companion will tug on the planet that we're seeing and cause its transits to not be exactly periodic, but to vary by very small amounts.
Well, and I'm looking at these diagrams that came out, and how can you measure this? This is just so minuscule. I think in terms of pixels, and I don't know what the right phrase is for the light signatures, but you know, how in the world is it just that you can be that sensitive is the part that I don't get.
Well, again, this is why we did something that is very single purpose, to get very good precision of the photometry, the amount of light that's coming to us from each star. And that's why we had to go above the atmosphere, and indeed, not just above the atmosphere, but away from Earth. Now, we're not a huge distance from Earth. We're in an orbit very similar to Earth, but it goes around the sun. Our spacecraft goes a little bit less rapidly around the sun. Mm-hmm. Its year is about 53 weeks, very similar to the orbit of the Spitzer Space Telescope. Okay. So Kepler is going gradually away from us. And the reason for that is because we don't want to be near the Earth. If we're near the Earth, we have the problem of particles in Earth's magnetic field. We have problems of occasionally being, or maybe even very frequently, being shadowed by Earth.
Right.
So this affects our electronics, and we need higher precision than that.
Wow. Okay. And if I understand the candidate deal, basically, let's just say, you know, you've only been up there since March of 2009, and you've been looking for a year or whatever. And so a planet comes across the disk, and you detect it. And so, okay, there you go. That looked good. But now you've got to wait for that planet way out there, 2,000 light years away, to circle around its sun again and then go across the disk, probably the time that I'm going to guess you can predict, and then wait for it to see it and then confirm that that's a planet?
Well,
with about 30 seconds.
You've got the basic idea right, but it's even more than that. Because, first of all, we can, if we just see one transit, we can have an idea of when it's going to come back, but we can't predict it well. When we see two transits, then we can predict the third transit very well. But we also are uncertain whether it's actually a planet transiting the star or maybe a binary star in the background.
Oh, okay. Jack, hang on. Stand by just for a moment. We're going to pause, take our usual 5-minute built-in hold so everyone can get caught up on the latest news, weather, and sports. When we return, we'll talk more about Kepler and its hunt for new planets. When we return, Space Talk brought to you by Space Florida. I'm Jim Banky. You're listening to WMMB.
With everything you need to know about America's space program, here is Jim Banky.
And welcome back to our second half of Space Talk on WMMB, brought to you by Space Florida, committed to expanding Florida's aerospace enterprise. Space Talk also brought to you today by the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex, the only place in Brevard County where you can still see the movie Tron Legacy in 3D and at an IMAX theater. All the other great attractions, of course, await you at the Visitor Complex, including the Shuttle Launch Experience, the Apollo Saturn V Center, and lots more. It all adds up to a day of fun and a lifetime of inspiration. Get all the details online at thekennedyspacecenter.com. Once again, kennedyspacecenter.com. Well, let's return our attention now back to the hunt for more planets out in the galaxy by the Kepler spacecraft. And one of the co-investigators of the Kepler team, Jack Lissauer, joins us from the Ames Research Center in California. A little bit of south of San Francisco, a little bit of north of Silicon Valley, kind of on the edge there at Moffett Field. I was there for the first time late last year, I guess, and a remarkable center doing a lot of different kind of things. And, Jack, one of the things they're doing is to look for planets with Kepler. Talk a little bit about what it's been like since the launch in March and getting up and going. And you know, is there a first light moment for Kepler, a first planet moment that you had that was kind of a memory?
Well, Jim, the first light was a little different from the first planet moment. And we sent back, within about a month of launch, a first light image once we had removed the dust cover. And this image showed the picture of all the stars in the field of view. And we only send back about one of those a month because there are an awful lot of pixels in the field of view. Mm. And this spacecraft is going away from Earth. So what we do is we pick out about 150,000 stars that are of particular interest to us, and we just send the pixels around those back to us. First planet, that took a while because not only did we have to see multiple transits, but we had to conduct a huge amount of follow-up work with telescopes on the ground to demonstrate that these candidates we had were indeed true planets.
Now that intrigues me a little bit because I heard that talk during the press conference, and I wasn't really sure how the other telescopes would help. I mean, again, you're not imaging actual bodies in space. Are you still looking for dips in the light, or what are they doing?
Well, you're right that we're not imaging actual bodies in space, but they're mostly doing spectroscopy.
Okay.
And if possible, we are looking and seeing by the Doppler method whether the star is wobbling. And that will not only confirm the existence of the planet, but it will also give us a mass. And when we know the mass of a planet as well as its radius, we can understand something about what it's made of.
Mm-hmm.
It also is necessary for us to do spectroscopy to find out how big the star is, because Kepler measures the amount of the dip in light, which gives us the ratio between the radius of the planet and the radius of the star. So if we want the radius of the planet itself, we need the radius of the star, which we get spectroscopically.
Now as a doctorate in applied math and all that, you know, I wonder how difficult the math is. I mean, is the getting the numbers the tough part and the math fairly easy to crunch, or again, is this just so far out there that it takes a guy like you with a doctorate to figure it all out?
Well, it's not, the math isn't that complicated. It's really just applying Newton's equations many times to model things. Now, my special emphasis is on those targets which have not just one planetary candidate, but multiple planetary candidates.
A whole system.
A whole system. And indeed, my major research effort over the past several months has been looking into the target star that had the largest number of planetary candidates, which was 6. And we were able to verify that all 6 of these were indeed planets, and we called the system Kepler-11.
Mm-hmm.
5 of those planets we verified by the slight changes in transit times, by about 10 or 20 minutes compared to their orbital periods between 10 days and a month and a half, that are caused by the perturbations they gravitationally exert on one another. And that requires some math to go backwards. We can integrate equations forward if we know the masses of the planets and where they are, but to integrate backwards to do the inverse problem of deducing masses when we just have the measured transit times, that's a bit trickier.
And again, that whole thing just was like, that just sent a buzz through my head. You know, it's like, that's tough to get your arms around, you know, to have so many, to be tracking so many of these things around one system so far away, to confirm the things, to figure out the math, you know, it's just amazing. What do you do with it all now, Jack? What do you do with it? Is it now just confirming everything? I mean, when are we going to start? You know, some of the folks that I've talked with just want to go right to, when do you start naming the planets, and when do we pack the spaceship and go?
Well, Jim, I'm coming from a theoretical viewpoint, and I want to find out what these planetary systems tell us about the formation process of planets, and this will have implications for the habitability of planets.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in terms of naming them, that's, as we say here, above my pay grade.
Not my table. Hey, we do have a question from Barry in Palm Bay for you, Jack, having to do with star and planet sizes. Barry, welcome to Space Talk.
Thank you, Jim. By the way, did you get the copy of the Patrick Air Force Base newspaper I left for you last week?
If that was you, yes, it did.
That was me.
Thank you.
You're welcome, sir. From our perspective, we consider a planet is, you know, one size, a star is another size. And obviously, that's from our position because we're humans. But isn't it possible that there may be life on bodies out there, and maybe they inhabit the stars as opposed to something as small as we consider a planet?
Well, Barry, we can't exclude that. You're right. All we can do is say we know that a planet which has liquid water on its surface is a good abode for life. And therefore, since we can't see the life on any body that we're studying, the best we can do is to try and find planets out there, see how many there are, which would likely have oceans and lakes and places that life on Earth is likely to find suitable.
Can you make a silly guess and say, when in our future do you think we'll ever be able to maybe put some real live explorers out there to check us out?
Well, in terms of actually going to these planets,
centuries.
That's going to be centuries.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. Barry, thanks for the call. And to get to some of that stuff, Jack, you know, we're talking about, you know, we have to figure out how to go a lot faster. If you're talking about a planet that's 2,000 light years away, just to go the speed of light, which we can't go, would take us 2,000 years. Can you imagine traveling in a ship that takes half the speed of light, you know, and how far that would take, and how many generations, you know, you'd have to live on this ship to get there with basically almost nothing to do between here and there but just coast. You know, it's an amazing prospect. And I think one we'll figure out one day, but during your press conference, and I got to wrap up here pretty quick, but during your press conference there was talk about building the cathedral. And you guys right now are building the floor of a cathedral that's going to take 400 or 500 years to finish building.
Right, but we're going to get something back from that before the cathedral is fully built, because we are going to be able to investigate these planets with new telescopes that are being built, that are being planned, and that will be planned as a result of new technologies and new scientific findings that will come within the next several years or at least in the next several decades.
Now let me ask you this, and again I need a quick answer, but when you got into this and you're interested in all that, when you got into this, did you pretty much assume that planets were going to be out there? This can't be a surprise that there are this many planets. This just is confirming something I would think would be common sense, that of course there are planets out there.
Well, you're right. It's confirming that there are a lot of planets out there, but we didn't expect to have planets and planetary configurations like what we're seeing with Kepler.
Really? And on that, I think we're going to have to tease it and say that we're going to have to do this again, and we're going to have to do it again when there's some more information from Kepler, and we'll get you back on the air and get updated. Jack, thanks for spending time with us today, okay?
Oh, my pleasure.
Really appreciate it. There goes Dr. Jack Lissauer, part of the Kepler planetary team, working that stuff in deep space, stuff that was launched, I might add, again, from Cape Canaveral Air Force Station. This is all that stuff started right here. Well, we're going to take a break. When we come back, Pat McCarthy from Space Florida will join us. We'll get you caught up on stuff. And, yes, that's right, I'm going to make my Super Bowl pick. So stand by for all that. This is Space Talk, brought to you by Space Florida. I'm Jim Banky. You're listening to WMMB.
And now back to Space Talk on WMMB.
And indeed, welcome back as we begin our final segment of today's edition of Space Talk, sponsored by Space Florida. On the phone with us again for a weekly update from Space Florida, our good friend, the director of spaceport operations for Space Florida, Mr. Patrick McCarthy, joins us. Pat, welcome.
Thanks, Jim. Glad to be here.
Good. What's new at Space Florida?
Well, we had a big week this week. We had an announcement. We signed a memorandum of understanding with Robert Bigelow, who owns Bigelow Aerospace.
And, right.
We're going to be doing some exciting new things here in the Space Coast area and around the state with him, including putting up, I guess you could call it a customer showroom or an exhibit hall, where hopefully we'll put up some scale models of his expandable space habitats so that we can show those off to potential customers as well as to investors and the state legislature and some other folks so that they understand what Mr. Bigelow is going to be doing with his on-orbit habitats.
Yeah, there's been a little reluctance, I think, in the space community, not to Bigelow himself, but just to the concept of the inflatable structure. And I know there's some politics at the Washington level that go into that, that's beyond above you and me. But I think it's really neat that this stuff's going to get out there for people to take a look at. And again, do you have any details yet as to when that might happen or where that will be set up?
Well, we're not sure yet where. We're researching a few places around the Space Coast where we might do that. But it's looking like we want to have something. He wants to fly by 2015. So we're looking in the next year or two probably to get this capability set up, and then we'll start looking for manufacturing space and things like that so we can get them ready to launch.
Wow, that's incredible. Just incredible. So job possibilities there? It's more than just a couple of people to run an exhibit hall. If Bigelow starts doing business here, he's going to have to bring a team and a building and all sorts of stuff.
Well, absolutely. And he's talking, on the order of 1,000 to 2,000 jobs because of the number of habitats and the number of launches that he wants to do. He's got customers from 7 or 8 different nations that are already interested. And that doesn't even count the industry folks from the non-traditional kinds of industries that are looking to get into space to do research and development. So we're probably talking 25 flights a year to support that, sending crews and cargoes up to his different habitats. And he's talking about 2 or 3 space stations. So, it's going to get pretty busy. He's going to need a pretty big workforce to support all that.
Your relationship with Bigelow Aerospace, is it one such that if I'm a guy out there and have an idea and I want to fly it on this structure, I need access to space, do I need to call you? Do I need to call Bigelow? Or who do I call?
Well, we can put him in touch with Mr. Bigelow. Obviously, that's what Space Florida is here for, is to talk to entrepreneurs and to researchers that have some ideas. So, you get in contact with us through www.spaceflorida.gov, and we'll put you in touch with the right folks.
Okay, sounds good. Pat, thanks for the update. We'll talk to you again, next week.
Okay, Jim, take care.
Thanks. There goes Pat McCarthy of Space Florida, major sponsor of Space Talk, and we're glad to talk to him every week and let you know what they're doing and how they can help everyone in the space community to grow what we're doing here in Florida in so many different ways. Well, in our few more minutes remaining, it is, that's right, Super Bowl weekend. Tomorrow, the big game. Yeah, thank you. And you know very well how much I love the game of football, the NFL, my beloved Minnesota Vikings. I'm even getting more and more interested in college now with my youngest son, Alex, going to UCF and all the success they're having with their program over there. But I did want to tie this together with the space program, and I'm not kidding. There's such a direct link. It's just absolutely unbelievable. The NFL has a link to the space program, has the space program to thank for so much of its success through the years. I've written about this in the past. When you consider it's so many different ways. In terms of direct from space in the form of DirecTV, I've not missed a Viking game in years, whether I wanted to watch it or not, because I've got the satellite dish. I've got the DirecTV program. You think about some of the composites, plastics, space-age materials, if you will, that are used in things like helmets to protect the players and the emphasis on the concussions this year. Again, you're seeing so many different styles of helmets come out now because of the expertise that we have in that. The medical equipment that's now available on the field and in the locker rooms, the portability and the capability comes directly from all of that medical instrumentation and technology that has been developed through the years, going back to Apollo. And I'm not going to apologize for space technology that comes from Apollo that's still useful today. There's some folks out there who, when you drag out the Apollo spinoffs, just kind of groan and moan and say, well, it's the same old thing. Well, I'm sorry, buddy. But that same old thing is still saving lives. It's still making a difference in people and the quality of their life. And so that stuff's still out there, to use. And the overall high techness, if you will, of the NFL and of the players. Of course, the players today growing up, they know how to run their gadgets. That, they've got their iPods and iPads, and when we talk about players and coaches watching film, that's still the term they use, but they're not watching film. They're watching high-definition video. And I was particularly struck when I went to Jacksonville to their training camp one year. And I'm not going to have a time to tell this whole story, but what they were able to do with their training video and the coaches were able to manipulate it, it's absolutely just interesting the way that it can all work. And this business about space supporting our sports programs, when I grew up And I remember watching on Saturdays and Sundays, you know, ABC Wild World of Sports, how oftentimes, especially the downhill skiing and the ski jumping, I remember seeing the words, you know, live via satellite or live via telecom or SATCOM or something. Just, again, it's been there for so long. And you, when you watch the game tomorrow and you see the technology that goes behind the production and bringing it to you, so much of that is directly linked to space, not only, you know, in a behind-the-scenes capability, but also from the fact that you wouldn't be watching that signal because, you know, without a satellite in space, launched from the Cape, launched from a variety of places, often built right here in the United States. So enjoy the game. Realize that that's all happening and feel like it's a part of it. And by the way, don't forget to watch the pregame show. Robonaut 2 is going to make a guest appearance with Howie Long, I think it is. And so that's going to be interesting. And what's my pick for tomorrow? Okay, well, here it is. My pick, Packers will win by kicking a last-minute field goal, put them on top, 17-14. Packers beat the Steelers in the Super Bowl. There you go. It does not mean I'm a Packer fan, by the way. I'm rooting for the NFC and the team with the big legend. The Banky family will be enjoying Frankie's Wings with the wet number threes, just in case you're wondering. And I guess that's about all the time we've got. We better wrap it up. Next week on Space Talk, Mike McCauley will be here. He was going to be here this week. He had to go back home to Houston. He'll be here next week. And that's about it. Space Talk, sponsored by Space Florida, is a production of Mylas Solutions. Aaron Michaels is my personal chief engineer. Up next, of course, on WMMB is the Home Mortgage Law Show. So do please stay tuned for that. I'm Jim Banky, and we'll talk to you again real soon. Go Packers!